tasseled pillows, fine silks and scarves spilling from its sides, as if it had been disemboweled. Andreas shut his eyes tightly, looking as though he wished he could conjure up another fate. Uncle reached the trunk first, halting ever so slightly before bending in for a closer look. My pulse quickened with each step I took. I knew there was a body, but the discovery of who was a wretched thing. Finally, I stood over the trunk and peered down, stomach churning.
Mrs. Prescott!
I clapped a hand over my mouth, shaking my head. The mother who had seemed so devastated and lost after her daughter had been killed at our table, always staring out at the endless sea. Part of me longed to sink to my knees, trying to search for a pulse that I knew had long since ceased. I could not fathom telling the chief magistrate that not only had this cruise ship taken his daughter, but now his wife. The invitation he'd received swam through the forefront of my mind. The murderer clearly wanted the Prescott women aboard this ship in order to kill them. Though why he'd kill Mrs. Prescott quietly and leave her in a trunk seemed to differ from his normal theatrics. Perhaps he was desperate to lay the blame on someone else. Maybe planting her body here would lead us to investigate Andreas. He was, after all, well-versed in tarot meanings. Instead of falling apart, I inhaled deeply.
We need to notify her husband at once.
I barely recognized my voice. It was cool and unwavering, so unlike my churning emotions. Mephistopheles stared at me a moment before nodding. I faced my uncle.
Let's get her decent for his identification. You take her arms, I'll get her legs. We'll place her on that settee in the corner.
32. Five of Hearts. Music Room. RMS Etruria. 7 January, 1889.
Come, let's get you settled with some brandy.
Captain Norwood extended an arm toward the Chief Magistrate.
If there's anything else you need.
Chief Magistrate Prescott stared, unblinking, at his wife. I could not fathom his thoughts.
With all due respect, Captain, Uncle said, I have a few questions for Chief Magistrate Prescott first.
The Captain's face turned crimson.
Not now, Doctor! Can't you see he's a wreck?
Chief Magistrate Prescott didn't even respond to his name. He was most decidedly in shock. But Uncle was correct. We needed to press him for information that would be useful immediately. Time had a strange way of distorting facts. However, Uncle relented.
All right, we'll call on him later.
Once the captain had led the stricken man out of the room, I turned back to the body of Mrs. Prescott, doing my best to divorce myself from memories of her in life. We'd laid her across a settee and propped her head up on an embroidered pillow, giving her the appearance of a peaceful rest, albeit an eternal one.
Close and latch the door,
Uncle said, directing his attention to Thomas, then inspected Mephistopheles as if he were a new brand of mold that we needed to be rid of.
Take your fortune teller and swordsman and leave us. We'll speak more later.
Jian's eyes flashed.
What else is there to say? Andreas came here to divine Mrs. Harvey's future with the magic looking glass. That's when he...
He shook his head.
Forget it. I'll be in my cabin. Come on, Andreas.
The fortune teller glanced toward the looking glass, biting his lip.
No harm will come to...
I'll make sure none of your belongings are ruined, I said. I knew how valuable the looking glass was, and not simply because of its supposed ability to see into the future. With that, both he and Jian left, the ringmaster giving us a curt nod before following them out.
I'll escort Mrs. Harvey back to her rooms, Liza offered. Don't worry, she added when Thomas looked ready to protest. I'll stay with her until you return.
I clutched my cousin's hands once. Thank you.
Of course.
As Liza guided a still muttering Mrs. Harvey out the door, the first mate came in with Uncle's medical bag. Uncle motioned to the foot of the settee.
There is fine. Now then, Audrey Rose, come inspect the body. Tell me what you notice. Thomas, are you ready?
My friend removed the journal and pen from his inner jacket pocket, a grim set to his lips.
Yes, Professor. Good. Audrey Rose, do as we've practiced.
I swallowed the growing lump in my throat, forcing myself to see only this new case. I walked around the body, trying to locate any clue before picking up the measuring tape, as Uncle had done earlier. Victim is 157 centimeters. Reddish brown hair, neatly maintained, though there are some bits of grey near her temples. I steeled myself and peeled back her eyelid. Eye color is brown. I held in my gasp. Petechial hemorrhaging is present in the whites of her eyes. At this, Uncle stepped forward and peered into her unseeing eyes.
Excellent, niece. We have the likely cause of death, suffocation.
I nodded, slowly seeing her last moments unfold in my mind. There were no signs of strangulation on her throat, no abrasions or contusions on her flesh. However, her lipstick was smeared, leading me to believe she'd been smothered by something. A glance around the room showed plenty of potential murder weapons. Pillows, silks, and fabrics. Any one of them could have been the object that ended her life. I leaned over and lifted her hand, noting the body was warm to the touch. She'd been slain very recently. Andreas had apparently entered the cabin with Mrs. Harvey, but I'd no idea when Gian had arrived. I'd need to investigate his whereabouts more. I pointed out the pillows and fabrics to Uncle. If this is the murder scene, which I believe it is, since I cannot imagine someone dragging her body here without witnesses, then I'd wager we'll find a bit of her lipstick on whatever was used to smother her.
Yes, what else?
I slowly walked from her feet to her head and back again, taking in every outer detail I could. Part of her skirts were cut. There, see? The fabric was snipped away in a line, too neat to have been torn in a struggle. I believe it happened after she'd been murdered. Thomas stood, lifting the edge of her outer skirts to better inspect the missing fabric length. It was a beautiful garment, pale as freshly fallen snow, with bits of silver threaded through. The contrast of the purity of color against her sudden death seemed gruesome. She appeared ready for a wedding, not a funeral.
Whoever committed this particular murder seems to have an obsession with pretty fabrics, despite how odd that may sound, he said, straightening up. I believe that's at least part of our motive, though not likely the main reason.
The three of us looked at one another, minds seemingly racing in new directions. There was one person who immediately sprang to mind while thinking of nice fabrics. The same young ringmaster that I kept defending. I glanced back down at the missing length of silk. I could no longer deny that it was becoming harder to clear Mephistopheles from at least some guilt. Though I could also not deny that something about the motive didn't quite sit right in my center. Uncle had taught us the importance of trusting our instincts. But I no longer could. At least, not where the ringmaster was concerned. Dozens of costumed performers emerged from each corner of the room, picking their way around tables, silent and ironically frightening in their joker's hats with dangling bells. Their full masks were white with tarry black diamonds painted around their eyes that dripped down to crimson lips. It seemed no matter what horror the afternoons brought, the evening shows would go on. A symphony composed of Renaissance instruments fiddled an old tune, the violins and harps sounding mournful, giving the impression of having gone back a few centuries in time. Against my best efforts, I shuddered at the puppet-like performers. If these Venetian jesters were terrifying, I hated to see the plague mask act come to life. Mephistopheles' imagination was a dark and treacherous place. Stiff white tulle ruffles around their collars and hips evoked images of ballerinas who'd broken free from Hades, but at a great cost. Black and gold triangles of fabric completed the collar and skirts,
and also made up the waistcoat and sleeves. I didn't know how these hellions could ever be considered humorous. They certainly didn't invoke any feelings of levity as they danced and hopped from one nimble foot to the next in quiet procession through the room. I couldn't help imagining their costumes being pieced together from a collection of fabrics stolen from victims, a macabre trophy that the killer could secretly admire each night. I knew it wasn't probable or likely, but it didn't prevent goose flesh from rising on my arms. Thomas eyed them the way one might stare at a horrid accident, his lip curled. I wanted to laugh, but couldn't find the will to do so after our somber afternoon studying Mrs. Prescott's corpse. I also couldn't ignore the tension from our earlier argument. It had been stuffed away in light of the larger issue, but the uncomfortable feeling persisted.
"The flame-tossing jugglers, I understand," he said. "But this? What exactly is their purpose? They're simply peculiar. Mephisto is losing his touch. Perhaps he's finally made a bad bargain, which isn't unexpected. No one's as perfect as me." "This entire carnival is peculiar," Uncle muttered. "I'll be glad to be done with it all. One more night after this now."
Liza lifted a delicate shoulder. She was unable to participate in the show, since Uncle was in attendance this evening, but didn't appear too upset by it. Her gown was exceptionally gorgeous tonight, beaded crystals sewn onto a rose petal pink. "That's precisely the point. Their peculiarity is the draw. You're so focused on them, I bet you haven't noticed what's being hauled out onto the stage." My attention snapped to the next act that had quietly come in when all eyes were focused elsewhere. Liza sat back, a smug look on her face. Even Uncle appeared surprised for a brief moment before tucking into his meal again. "Love or loathe him, you have to admit Mephistopheles is remarkable. He knows exactly what distractions to use." My cousin's gaze landed on me for emphasis, and I wished to slowly crawl under the table. She was most decidedly not helping my cause. "Harry has learned so much in just a few short weeks. Mephistopheles is quite the teacher."
"And," Uncle said under his breath, "possibly quite the murderous fiend as well."
Deciding to don bravery like it was my most exquisite accessory, I glanced at Thomas. He looked like he'd swallowed a toad. I politely coughed a laugh away. At that, he offered a tentative smile, and I did too. It was good to be back on the same side.
"Yes," Thomas said blandly. "Next we'll be hearing that he's walked across the sea."
"If he attempts that, then I'm sure a siren or whale will swallow him whole," I said. Thomas perked up at the thought. I turned to my cousin and leaned close to avoid being overheard by the diners at the nearest table. "Would Harry use theatrics as a distraction to something more serious? What if one of his experiments went terribly wrong? Would he tell anyone, or simply try and make the bodies disappear? You have to admit, the trunk is a very Houdini way of disposing of something." Liza stared at me as if I'd gone mad. "Missing and murdered women are not the best way of having his performances end up in the papers, cousin. Harry wants fame, not infamy. Same goes for Mephistopheles. You can't honestly believe they're to blame."
"What if that's what he wants you to believe?" Thomas asked. "Perhaps fame is the misdirection. Do you really know what he's after?"
Liza opened her mouth, then shut it. I imagined she was taking her mother's advice to count to 10 before speaking when a kind word couldn't easily be found. "Harry would not be involved with anyone who was..." "What? Do you both think Mephistopheles is actually a murderer?" She snorted, forgetting about manners. "If you want to throw accusations around, you ought to investigate Captain Norwood. Have you seen the way he treats his crew? I wouldn't doubt he'd be capable of tossing people overboard if they displeased him. The man is an absolute nightmare." On that much we were agreed. I could see the captain shoving someone over the railing in a fit of rage. He was an odd character. At once completely pleasant and docile, and when angered, fierce and nasty as they came. But I did not believe he had an ounce of theatrical violence in that well-structured suit of his. Mrs. Harvey leaned across the table, lips still trembling from the shock she'd received earlier. I wished to reach over and embrace her. Shaken though she was, she refused to sit alone in her chambers. Thomas had offered to stay and dine in with her, but she'd have none of it. I had an inkling it had to do with the rumor of Houdini sporting his underthings once again that gave her an extra push to attend the show. Though most other passengers must not have felt the same, the dining saloon was even more empty tonight than it had been yesterday. The ship was slowly turning into a ghost vessel. Places once filled with life now seemed haunted and silent.
"What do you think is behind that curtain?" she asked. "I hope it's not another milk can. I didn't care for that act one bit. Too much tension isn't good for your constitution. I don't think I can handle another fright so soon."
"Cousin, what secrets can you offer?"
I turned to Liza, ready to lighten the mood with a joke, when the lights flashed, then went out, leaving us in darkness, broken only by candles flickering on our tables. Uncle muttered something about not being able to see his entree, but I decided not to comment.
"Esteemed guests,"
Mephistopheles's disembodied voice hung in the air like fog.
"Tonight, we ask you to turn your attention skyward, as the Empress puts on her most heavenly show. Note, there are no nets, and should she fall, well, let's not worry on that now."
A single light illuminated Cassie as she sat on her trapeze, staring out at the crowd. On her head was a crown with 12 glittering stars at the points. Her bodice had pomegranate seeds sewn across it to represent her ruling over the earth, according to Mephistopheles's lesson on tarot card meanings. She was regal and elegant, haughty and proud. With her hair in golden ringlets cascading down her back tonight, I could see how she embodied an ideal angelic figure, though I knew better than to be fooled by her innocent appearance. Her act started off slowly. She swayed from one end of the room to the other, swinging from one trapeze to the next, seeming to delight whenever her fingertips left the safety of one and grabbed onto the other. I recalled longing for that sense of freedom when my brother and I had attended a circus during the Ripper murders. There was something beautiful about letting go. A second floodlight announced another performer joining her ranks. The young man twisted and flipped, crisscrossing over Cassie as their tricks became more intricate.
"That's Sebastian," Liza whispered. "He uses the contortion angle quite well for this act."
I watched the contortionist with renewed interest. Was he capable of killing the women aboard this ship and staging their bodies so horridly? I hadn't gotten to speak with him, and noticed he'd shy away each time I'd get close. As he flew back and forth above us, tumbling across the sky, I could certainly imagine the hidden strength in his lithe body. What remained of the dining saloon politely enjoyed the show, though there was a considerable feeling of subdued awe present. I wondered if it was fear of things turning deadly, or the lack of that very essence. These passengers were the most unaffected by the crimes, though they might be putting on an act of their own until this nightmare ceased.
"Ladies and gentlemen,"
Mephistopheles's voice echoed, though he was nowhere to be seen.
"Prepare to be enthralled. Our stage has been set, and this next act is sure to dazzle and stun. Please contain yourselves as the great Houdini attempts to escape death once more in his infamous torture cell."
Thomas made to open his mouth when a third light suddenly flashed on, and the curtain hiding the object on stage was lifted away by invisible hands. I shouldn't have been surprised by the intake of breath or the subsequent screams as people began piecing together what they were looking at. Suspended inside the torture cell, a glass tank filled with water, a woman stared out at us with milky white eyes. I would believe her to be a mermaid of legends, if not for the obvious fact she was very real and very dead. What appeared to be 5 anatomical hearts were skewered with long rods through her limbs, discolored from being submerged. On the front of the glass, a playing card was posted, too small to make out from where I sat. Someone vomited near us,
but I couldn't tear my gaze from the tank. It took a few moments to snap myself free of my own terror and realize Miss Victim was familiar to me. The woman in the tank was none other than Lady Crenshaw.
33. Motive. Dining Saloon, RMS Etruria, 7 January, 1889. Venetian jesters near the stage faltered, their disjointed steps no longer part of their roles, but from their fear, that felt thick as tar permeating the room. They stood still, openly gaping at the dead woman, their silence more frightening than it had been while they pranced about from foot to foot. If there had been any hope left of this being some horrid part of the show, it withered immediately. A heartbeat later, the audience fully grasped what had startled our entertainers enough to cease their creepy procession. Knives clattered to plates, gasps went around the room, and, judging from the sound of a body slamming into a surface, at least one passenger had passed out. I could hardly blame them. The sight of Lady Crenshaw floating in that tank, with her whitish eyes and long hair winding through the water, was straight out of a penny dreadful. A tale almost too wretched to be real. As if they were star performers, accepting their own roles in this horror show, Uncle and Thomas sprang from their seats and rushed to the tank. I tossed my napkin on the table and half stood, ready to run after them, but didn't wish to leave Liza and Mrs. Harvey unattended. Even with the steady hum of terror pounding through my body, one truth calmed me. I didn't believe anyone else was in immediate danger. At least, not yet. Uncle shouted at the frozen carnival crew, "Draw the curtains!" Almost instantly the demand was obeyed, and the inky curtains quickly fluttered shut, taking with them the view of the submerged corpse. I stared at the velvet drapery, thoughts churning. If Thomas and Uncle hadn't acted so quickly, I might have been able to convince myself I'd invented such a morbid sight. Another staged body. It was almost unfathomable. Last month I'd studied the insides of a drowning victim. I could not shake the image of those blue lips and bloated belly from my mind, no matter how hard I tried. Only that man had died as the result of a horrid accident. Lady Crenshaw likely had not. Captain Norwood appeared from somewhere near the stage and began ordering his staff and crew about, like a general commanding his army. Within seconds of his arrival, passengers were rushed through the doors. Regardless of how many bizarre murders we'd borne witness to, the patrons didn't make the evacuation task an easy one. Chaos and discord raced about the room, dragging people to the floor, crushing them under the fleeing crowd. I blinked, unmoving, at the scene, as if I were a mere apparition, spying on the goings-on in hell. Surely if such a place existed, it would appear exactly like this. A small fire flared up near the back of the room, the result of candles falling onto the table linens. "Go!" Liza clutched my hands in hers, eyes wide but determined. "Uncle needs you up there. I'll take Mrs. Harvey to our room. Again." I blinked back a sudden prickling in my eyes, and Liza tugged me into a crushing embrace. "Everything is going to be all right. We'll be in New York by midnight tomorrow. We just need to make it through one more day." I nodded, unable to do more, and stepped back. Once they'd made their way toward the exit, I gathered my skirts and ran as swiftly as I could up the stairs and ducked behind the velvet curtains. Mephistopheles stood, hands on his hips, staring at the dead woman.
"I'm telling you, it's simply not possible for her to have done this alone," he said.
His tone implied it wasn't the first time he'd shared this information, and he was trying to remain calm despite the floating body in his show's prop. He pointed to the top of the contraption.
"See those locks? Someone slid them into place. It takes two of my men to fit the tank together. Once she'd gone in the water, there's no possible way for her to maneuver the lid and then lock it. And do you honestly believe she skewered five hearts and then posted the playing card of the same name on the glass?"
"What does the five of hearts mean?" I asked, no longer worried about what suspicions I might raise. "You know cartomancy, right?" Mephistopheles rubbed his brow.
jealousy. It means ill will of the people surrounding you.
It makes sense, given her letter, Thomas said.
Letter? I moved to Thomas's side and noticed a square of paper in his hand. He glanced over and handed me the note while Uncle moved around the tank, taking in the details. I quickly scanned the paper, pulse galloping as I read the hurried script. My actions led to the death of that girl. I purposely overpaid her in the name of charity after my husband admired her beauty, then claimed she'd stolen from us when my husband inquired about the missing coin. I wanted her to know that while she might have been pretty for a street wretch, likely earning more than just compliments from married men, she survived because of upstanding citizens such as myself. I was envious, and that flaw has cost me my most precious gift, my daughter. I cannot live with the guilt. I'm truly sorry for all that I've done. I reread the letter, brows drawn together. Which girl is she speaking of?
That's the question of the hour, Wadsworth. Thomas lifted a shoulder. Perhaps she's discussing something that occurred off the boat. In fact, he pointed to the second line, I guarantee that whatever this refers to happened before any of them boarded this craft. I believe this is our murderer's motive.
Understanding dawned bright as the sunrise. All we have to do is figure out who this refers to, and then we'll have our murderer.
Mephistopheles sidled up to my other side and snorted.
Oh, is that all? That shouldn't be difficult in the slightest.
Thomas eyed him in a way that had me already shaking my head.
Perhaps not to someone such as yourself, he said. However, someone with a bit more wit and intelligence can make connections. Observe.
Thomas gently took the letter back and cleared his throat.
While she might have been pretty for a street wretch, based on this line, one with a semi-intelligent slant might deduce that the girl in question worked a profession that would be below Lady Crenshaw's station, but not so low as to prevent them from interacting, which leads one to consider a few possibilities.
You're unbearable, Mephistopheles muttered.
I smiled. He's only just beginning. Thomas ignored the commentary and ticked off probable jobs on his fingers.
Selling food? Selling trinkets? Selling ribbons or silks? Given Lady Crenshaw's status, I doubt she'd be the one doing any shopping for food supply. It would be too far beneath her. That task would be left to the kitchen staff. Next, I cannot picture her buying a trinket that didn't come from a more suitable shop. Exempli gratia. She would not bother with anything that didn't cost a significant coin to boast about with the ladies at her weekly tea. Flowers, ribbons, or silks might be the key. It would show her wealth and ability to spend money on frivolous things.
Mephistopheles shook his head.
You're quite smart, aren't you?
Of course I am, Thomas said. Is that supposed to be insulting? Whatever will you comment on next? The golden flecks in my eyes? The sharpness of my jaw?
The extraordinary size of your ego?
An impish grin slowly spread across Thomas's face.
It's not the only prodigious thing I can boast about. Ignoring that sentiment, you're saying, if this were a story, you'd be the hero, correct?
Don't be ridiculous,
Thomas said, appearing truly offended.
I'm dark and mysterious, and as likely to kiss or kill you on a whim. Does that sound heroic to you? Not many heroes are good-looking masterminds. I, however, have harnessed my dark talents for the greater good.
Ah, I understand now.
Mephistopheles's lips twitched.
You're a lunatic.
I prefer unpredictable. It's got a nicer ring to it.
I cleared my throat.
Honestly, you're both infantile. Can we please focus on the poor woman in the tank?
Blessedly, Gian, Houdini, and Andreas picked that moment to come backstage. Each of them blanched at the sight of the corpse, but, to their immense credit, managed to tear their gazes away and not be sick. I noticed Anisha huddling just behind the curtain with Sebastian and Cassie, on their faces matching expressions of shock and terror. Harry gave Mephistopheles a steady look.
Everyone's talking about laying low until New York, then leaving for good.
The ringmaster's face set into a grim expression. He seemed almost resigned to the fact that his dreams were beyond salvaging. Something tugged deep within my center, longing to fix this whole situation. Before Mephistopheles could comment, I stepped forward.
"We're close to solving the murders," I said, raising my voice so they'd hear,
hoping I sounded much more confident about that fact than I felt.
"We've already discovered the profession of the girl Lady Crenshaw described in her letter. It shouldn't take too much longer to connect more pieces."
I glanced at each performer, then flicked my gaze to Mephistopheles. It was hard to discern anything for certain behind his mask, but I could have sworn I saw gratitude in his eyes.
"The show must go on," I said. "It's what you all do. Give the passengers a bit of hope and distraction. They need it, and you, more than ever. Let's make the finale something worth remembering."
34. Spectacular Suspect. First Class Promenade. RMS Etruria. 7 January, 1889.
"No, no, no."
Anisha shifted my ungloved hand down several inches. "If you hold the baton too close to the flame, you'll set yourself on fire. The skirts of our costumes are highly flammable with all the tulle. You need to hold it near the end." "Good. Now just move it around slowly. Pretend you're painting the sky with flames."
I quirked a brow. "Painting the sky with flames? Sounds like a dramatic canvas indeed."
Anisha slowly cracked a smile. It had only been a few hours since the discovery of Lady Crenshaw's body, and tensions were still high. "I used to paint, back before my life became this." The grin faded. "My family encouraged my creativity, though they never approved of the circus." A few moments of silence passed between us, broken only by the soft crackling of the fire. If I wasn't holding a torch, I'd give her a hug.
"Well, now you're a living bit of artwork. And that's an incredible..." "I read the letter! How are you going to deny it?"
Liza's piercing voice rang out. I briefly closed my eyes, not surprised, but dreading the fact my cousin was unleashing herself now. We were so close to New York. If only she could have held off for a bit longer.
"This is over. We are over. I do not wish to see or speak to you again."
"I ain't been writing to no one."
Liza, her face near burgundy, stomped through the dining saloon, ignoring each attempt Houdini made to halt her procession. Anisha and I exchanged nervous glances, but kept our mouths shut. I wished to be back on the trapeze with Cassie and Sebastian, far from the fireworks that were happening offstage. One more look in Anisha's direction proved she felt the same. The flame eater stared longingly toward the curtains, probably wishing she possessed the escape skills Houdini did.
"Liza, the only woman I write to is my mother. You gotta believe me."
"No, Harry, I don't gotta do anything."
She marched through the room and threw her mask at his feet.
"Take your lies and sell them to someone else. This conversation is over."
"I swear."
Mephistopheles strolled into the room with Gian and Andreas, halting when he saw Anisha and me holding on to our flaming batons, and Liza and Harry storming around.
"Lovers' quarrels are not permitted during practice. Please save the added drama for a private show only."
Liza offered her most withering glare to the ringmaster and lifted her chin.
"We're through here. Make sure he stays far away from me, or you'll have an entirely new spectacle on your hands."
With that, she slammed the door, rattling the glassware that had already been set up for tomorrow night's dinner. Harry made to follow after her, but Mephistopheles stopped him with a hand to the chest.
"Let her collect herself. It's never wise to push a person who's upset."
"But I ain't doing anything wrong."
"Let's go get ourselves a nice drink."
Mephistopheles wrapped an arm around the escape artist and escorted him around the tables and through to the other side of the room.
"We've got to stick together now. The show needs you at your best."
With one look over his shoulder at me, he led the distraught Houdini out. Anisha shook her head. "We should probably put these out. I've got to get some rest, and you need to do the same."
She leaned in and sniffed my hair. You might want to bathe before morning. Your hair smells a little like kerosene now. It'll be hard to hide that from Thomas or your uncle. I absently nodded and followed Anisha to a bucket of water that had been set up for us, extinguishing my flaming baton with a hiss of steam. Something about Houdini's insistence of innocence bothered me. He appeared genuine, his face screwed up in pain. Either he was an expert liar, or he'd been telling the truth, or a version of it. Which meant there was a strong possibility the ringmaster had crafted yet another illusion. One more lie to add to a list I feared was never-ending with him. Perhaps Houdini wasn't the one Liza needed to escape from, after all. A few hours later, I slipped from my chamber, hoping that enough time had passed for me to find who I was looking for. He wasn't lurking near the prow, which meant there were only two more places he'd be at this hour. I checked over my shoulder, ensuring I was alone, then headed toward the stairwell. I flew down the stairs, the metal biting into the soles of my feet, reminding me of how alive I was and how fleeting that could be. I burst into the animal cargo, and Mephistopheles jumped a little, but quickly recovered. He studied me from the shadows, and I replied in kind. His mask was firmly in place, though his shirt was wrinkled and damp. He appeared as horrible as I felt. You lied to me. I watched him closely, searching for any crack in the armor he wore as often as his masks. About Houdini's letter. He was writing to his mother, wasn't he? Mephistopheles didn't so much as blink, his gaze traveling from my eyes to my mouth, smirking a bit when he elicited a scowl.
I didn't lie, my dear. If you recall that night, I never claimed he'd been writing to a secret lover, did I?
Oh, you didn't? I scoffed. Then I suppose I produced the half-destroyed letter myself and crafted a story to go along with it all on my own.
He held my gaze, expression wiped clean of humor.
Consider it your first true lesson in sleight of hand, Miss Wadsworth. Sleight of word is also a valuable tool for any magician or showman. Our minds are magnificent conjurers, capable of endless magic. What I said and showed you that night was simply a half-ruined letter. Your mind fabricated a story. It jumped to its own conclusion. I never said he had a secret lover. I never claimed anything other than he writes to someone and sends a letter from each city.
I shook my head, wishing I could shake the man before me.
But you said he loved her.
Mephistopheles nodded.
I did. I imagine he loves his mother very much.
You claimed that Liza was unaware of the letters or woman. You made me think there was something more going on.
I went back to the night of our bargain, stomach sinking with each new memory of our conversation. He hadn't lied. He just hadn't been entirely truthful.
I what?
He asked.
I laid facts out for you, Miss Wadsworth. You assumed I meant lover. You assumed he was untrustworthy, simply because of our professions. Your prejudice interfered with your ability to inquire further, to ask more specific questions, to separate fact from the fiction of your mind. You had the opportunity to clear everything up. I would not have lied to you. That was a choice you made. And did I benefit from it? Of course I did. I make no denial of the fact I've used this method on people before, and I will most certainly do so in the future. If you're angry with anyone, it ought to be yourself as well. You created an illusion of the truth you wanted to see.
You're a terrible person.
I'm terribly accurate at reading humanity. Change human behavior, Miss Wadsworth, and I'll change my tactics.
You made me break Liza's heart for no good reason.
Really? Can you think of not one reason that's positive?
He cocked his head.
Do you truly believe that she belongs with an escape artist in a traveling carnival? Or is it a whim that has dire consequences? You did your cousin a favor, Miss Wadsworth. But sometimes they don't come in sweet-smelling bouquets. Houdini would have broken her heart eventually, or she would have broken his. The right choice isn't always the easy one.
He offered a slight bow.
I hope one day you'll understand that. Good night.
Oh, no, I said, marching after him and tugging him around to face me. You don't get to do that.
Do what exactly?
Pour kerosene, set it aflame, and walk away when the fire is too hot for your tastes?
He leaned against the lion's cage, expression thoughtful. I hoped the lion would decide to have a midnight snack. A foul and wretched thought, after knowing the animal had consumed at least part of one victim. A victim we'd yet to identify. I shuddered. Mephistopheles shrugged out of his tailcoat and draped it over my shoulders. The embroidered scarlet velvet reminding me a little too much of blood.
I use science and study the human mind, the same way you do, he replied calmly. Don't be angry you took the boring traditional route. You could still choose differently, you know. You want to set your world on fire? I'll give you a matchbox.
Boring, I parroted back. Pardon me if I do not find amusement in the idea of potentially destroying a life on a whim. Perhaps you ought to stick to crafting pretty costumes.
If you'd like to join my midnight carnival permanently and offer up more stellar ideas, you simply need ask.
You are completely mad if you think I'd care to join you or your depraved use of science and engineering for good. Your acts are violent, savage things. All they show us is how horrid the world can be.
I tossed my hands up when he smiled.
Why is this amusing?
I find your vehemence endearing.
I find your lack of compassion appalling, I said. Are you ever serious?
Of course I am. I am seriously the most honest person I know,
he said, his voice frustratingly calm.
Truth is a blade, brutal and ice cold. It cuts. Sometimes when spoken carelessly, it even scars. Our performances expose that fact and make no apology for it. Once again, if you're upset with anyone, it's yourself. What truth did you discover while that tank was unveiled tonight?
Aside from the body, I discovered that you're all willing to go too far for a stupid carnival.
Is that all?
He smirked.
Did you enjoy it? I'd wager your heart beat a little faster, your palms dampened with dread and expectation. We are all fascinated by death. It's the one thing each and every one of us has in common. No matter our station in life, we all must die. And we never know when it's coming for us. Seeing someone nearly drown in itself isn't scary or intimidating. It's the truth and realization of what truly excites us that is most disturbing.
I'm not sure I know what you're getting at.
Don't you, though?
He tilted his head.
Tell me, Miss Wadsworth, imagine this. When that curtain drops around the tank and the clock starts counting, those seconds ticking loud enough to cause arrhythmia, what is the whisper in your mind between heartbeats? Are you secretly praying that Houdini will make it through? Hoping against seemingly insurmountable odds that he will defeat death? Or are you sitting there, fists clenched below the table, both dreading and anticipating the possibility that you're about to witness something we all fear? What is most exciting, most terrifying?
I swallowed hard and didn't answer. I didn't need to. Even though we'd not gotten a chance to witness the act he spoke of, Mephistopheles already knew what I'd say anyway.
That is the truth we offer, he said. We are, all of us, desperate for a way to overcome the biggest threat of all, death. At the same time, we're all hungry when it comes for someone else. You may hate the truth, deny it, curse it, but the fact remains, you are equally enchanted by it. Knowing the flames are hot isn't always a deterrent from playing with fire.
When I said nothing, he lifted a shoulder, but there was a tightness around his mouth that belied his nonchalance.
Life, like the show, goes on whether we agree with it or not. If we stopped living, ceased to celebrate our existences in the face of death or tragedy,
then we might as well tumble into our own graves.
A thought struck me. Whose idea was it for the torture cell tonight? Yours, Houdini's, or the captain's?
Let's call it a mutual agreement.
The lion growled, startling Mephistopheles away from the cage. He straightened his waistcoat.
What did you learn regarding Mrs. Prescott's death?
That anyone, including him, might have placed her in that trunk. I shuddered. Two women, stuffed into a trunk and a tank. Both horrendous resting places. We're going to do a post-mortem in the morning. Her husband wished for one night to say goodbye.
You're confident you'll identify the cause of death, though?
He pressed. I nodded, not ready to admit we'd already discovered that she'd likely been smothered.
Interesting.
It's not really that interesting or hard, once you've practiced enough.
Some would say the work you do is impossible. Think on it a moment, if you will. You take a body, carve it open, and read clues left behind. Sounds impossible to anyone untrained in your field. Reading the dead, identifying cause of death by sight, by determining which organ wasn't functioning properly.
He walked in a circle, hands behind his back.
You have to get your hands messy, though, don't you? To do something others think is impossible, no matter what the arena or circumstance, your hands will get stained in the process.
I took an unsteady step backward, nearly losing my footing by the tiger's cage. There was an air of confession to his words, ones that made the little hairs along my arms stand at attention. I knew nothing of this young man, save for his ability at misdirection. My heart thundered. Was Mephistopheles using me as a sleight of hand this entire time? These midnight meetings might be his way of distracting Thomas, making him believe there was something clandestine happening between us, forcing him to overlook any other sinister acts he could be committing. Thomas might trust me, but no matter how hard he denied it, he was human. His emotions could be toyed with like any others, just as Liza had warned. And I'd been equally blinded by Mephistopheles. I was doing exactly what he'd asked, because I wanted to help my cousin at all costs. A fact he had noticed straight away. Magicians were trained to find marks in a crowd, and Mephistopheles was among the best. He watched me from the shadows, the caged lion prowling back and forth behind him. There was something dark and cunning to Mephistopheles, a cat with a full belly, who was deciding if the mouse was worth killing yet, or saving for another day when he truly hungered for it. I never quite knew which he desired more, and which thrilled me most. Perhaps I was as twisted and gnarled on the inside as he was. He didn't move closer, but managed to fill the space between us anyway. I longed for a clever retort, something to prove how unafraid I was, to win at his games. But he glanced down at my gloved hands pointedly.
If you wish to accomplish great things, sometimes you must get your hands dirty on the climb up. But you've already done that for your pursuits. It's a bit odd you don't allow me the same courtesy.
I noticed the smudge of dirt on my palms. I rubbed my hands together, but the stain refused to lighten. I must have grabbed onto the bars at some point, though the image of stained hands unnerved me. I'd dipped my hands into blood more times than I could count.
Thanks to rough water, the captain said we won't make land for one day now, Miss Wadsworth.
Mephistopheles turned to go, then paused, fingers tapping the door jamb.
I sincerely hope you solve these murders, for both our sakes. I'm not sure the carnival will survive another hit. There's more than one way to make a man drown.
35. Eight of Swords. Audrey Rose's Quarters, RMS Etruria, 7 January, 1889.
I slipped into my room, relieved to find it unoccupied. Liza must have stayed out with the other performers to work out her annoyance, and Mrs. Harvey was likely asleep. No one would be any the wiser about my midnight meeting with the devil. Maddening fool,
I sat on the edge of the bed, absently tracing the orchids stitched onto my silk skirts, Mephistopheles's words tumbling through my mind. There was most certainly more than one way of killing a man. Whoever had been terrorizing the ship was acquainted with that sentiment. I pulled the playing cards out from my nightstand and set them on top of the blankets. Half were found with bodies, and the other half were found near the crime scenes. Ace of clubs, six of diamonds, ace of spades, five of hearts. Yet the murders themselves were fashioned after tarot cards and their meanings. Five of hearts correlated to jealousy. Ace of clubs, wealth. Lady Crenshaw was most certainly jealous over some unidentified young woman. The ace of clubs had been staked through Miss Prescott on opening night. Perhaps her father had been bribed. I rubbed my temples. None of it made sense. Unless, perhaps, whoever was perpetrating these crimes was indicating he or she was laying their cards out for all to see. It was a stretch, but it might be a good place to start. I leafed through the other notes I'd jotted down and spread them next to the cards. Uncle believed sometimes a pattern might emerge or our brains might pick up on something after having written it down. His methods rarely failed me. I added a few new notes. Tarot card found in Jian's act, justice. Body impaled with seven swords. Dr. Arden's daughter, tarot seven of swords. I paused, recalling that Mephistopheles had said it was called a reversed seven of swords, and its meaning was something about a person who believed they'd gotten away with something, or so he'd said. So did that indicate that Dr. Arden's daughter had been in trouble? Might she have believed herself to be free from whatever crime she might have committed? I hadn't a clue where to go about locating that answer. Dr. Arden still refused to leave his chambers or answer the door, and the captain was growing antsier the closer to America we got. Moving along, I added the next bit of information. The Star Tarot, body burned on stage, emerald ring found, confirming Miss Crenshaw as deceased. Tarot meaning transformation? Six of diamonds found in her cabin, meaning to be determined. Poisonous belladonna found in stomach contents, cause of death. Severed arm found in lion's cage, still unidentified, likely male based on examination. Wedding band left untouched. Mrs. Prescott found suffocated in a trunk, no tarot. Connected how? Lady Crenshaw deceased in a tank, five of hearts instead of tarot. Note left detailing her perceived crimes. She could not have placed herself in that tank, however. Card meaning jealousy. I sat back and rolled my head one way and the other, stretching out my muscles. There was most certainly a consistency with the crimes, with the exception of the severed limb and the body found in the cargo hold. They did not appear to be connected with the other murders. Unless they had been unfortunate victims who happened upon the crimes and could report them to someone. And potentially identify the murderer. What am I missing? I asked aloud. What connects you all? What story do these cards tell with their meanings? I thought of Dr. Arden's odd behavior, of how he'd kept us from speaking with Chief Magistrate Prescott, how he openly lied to us. What might he be hiding both the Prescotts and himself from? And after his daughter's murder, why was he still unwilling to talk with us? A chief magistrate and a physician. A noblewoman with a guilty conscience. Two possible witnesses. Two different styles of cards. Both holding secret meanings to be deciphered. I nibbled on my lower lip, concentrating hard, as an idea slowly niggled around the edges of my brain. If Thomas was correct, then Lady Crenshaw had likely encountered a girl who sold something worthy of the Lady Crenshaw's attention. Ribbons didn't quite seem to have boasting factor over tea, though. Were I hosting a lavish party, or one that I'd like to seem as such, I'd purchase as many flowers as I could afford. That would make quite a statement of wealth. Especially if the flowers were from a hothouse. My pulse picked up. It was the most plausible scenario.
The Crenshaws and the Prescotts each received free passage on the Etruria and knew each other before setting sail. If Lady Crenshaw upset her husband enough, it might stand to reason that he'd gone to his friend, the chief magistrate, and filed a complaint against the flower girl. Did they not offer her a fair trial, instead sending her off to the workhouse, whose conditions were likely more deplorable than the streets she fought to survive on? But how did Dr. Arden fit into this theory? I pulled a tarot deck out that Mephistopheles had given me, tracing the filigree edges of the death card, thoughts churning. A man of medicine would be tasked with seeing patients, even those who'd committed crimes. Perhaps he'd been the prison physician and had administered a tonic that killed instead of saved. Maybe it was no accident. Maybe one of his powerful and rich friends asked him for this favor and he obliged. Might each of them be involved in some larger plot to cover their own crimes? It would explain why Dr. Arden wished to keep everyone from talking. The less they said, the less they could implicate themselves in a murder of their own doing. I glanced around the cabin. It was starting to get late enough that Liza ought to return soon, and the last thing she needed was to be surrounded by more trauma. I straightened the mess of evidence I'd collected and swept it into the nightstand, saving my tarot deck for last. My cousin had been through quite enough, and as I went to close the drawer, a small box with a ribbon closure caught my eye. My blood felt as if it cooled several degrees when I noticed the Eight of Swords tarot card that sat tucked beneath it. My initial reaction was to pick the box up and toss it across the room, screaming until someone was alerted. But my logical and curious self couldn't bear the thought of destroying any clues. Someone had purposely left this inside my nightstand, and I didn't believe it was out of kindness. Pulse speeding, I reached over and tentatively pulled the box into my lap. It wasn't very large, though I still hesitated to open it. A dark, wretched feeling settled around me. Whatever this box contained, it was not going to be pleasant. I stared at the tarot card, allowing a moment to pass to steel myself against this new task. A blindfolded woman stood prisoner in a cage of swords. Her entire body had been tied with silks, indicating there was no escape. Seemed like a good metaphor for this ship. I jerked my attention back to the box, breathing harder. I ought to run to Uncle's cabin and open it there. But it was late, and what could he do other than offer moral assistance? Surely, if he or Thomas received the box, they'd not wait to tear into it. Still, I gave myself another moment to focus on breathing steadily, and slowly, carefully, pulled the ribbon apart. Before I lost my nerve, I removed the lid. Inside, on a bed of crushed velvet, lay a finger. I blinked as the sounds in the room amplified. Suddenly I could hear every last tick of the clock, each ocean wave that quietly lapped against the hull of the ship. I even heard creaks coming from next door where Mrs. Harvey seemed to have awoken. All of it was too loud. I focused on inhaling and exhaling. I wanted to throw the box out of my room, but it would be both careless and extreme. A severed finger couldn't hurt me. A folded scrap of paper was wedged beneath the finger. A bit of blood splattered across the creamy cardstock. If I'd been disturbed by the finger, a whole new wave of trepidation crashed through me. A note from a killer was never a jolly good time. My own hands shook as I plucked it from the box, careful to avoid touching the new bit of evidence. I unfolded the note and was thankful I'd already been seated. Had I been standing, I was certain I'd have collapsed on the spot. Miss Wadsworth, this ought to be considered your first and last warning. Halt your investigation, or the next piece of your cousin you receive will be her head. My performance is nearly over, and should you play your new role of the obedient young woman, I will release Liza alive at port. Should you choose differently, your fate won't be the only one affected. I reread the threat, heart pounding faster than my thoughts. Liza,
Liza was in danger.
The murderer had her.
And I knew with every last fiber of my being that he meant every word. He'd already mutilated her poor innocent hand.